David for the next hour here this morning. There's a few things that I'd like to discuss in relation to David and the scheme of things as far as David is concerned, the circumstances in which David comes into the biblical story, before we really get into the life story of David himself. Among the things that I'd like to point out to you without going into any great detail on this is the sources that we have for the story and life of David. In 1 Chronicles chapter 29, at the close of the story of David, in verses 29 and 30, the writer of the Chronicles says, "As for the events of King David's reign from beginning to end, they are written in the records of Samuel the seer, the records of Nathan the prophet, and the records of Gad the seer, together with the details of his reign and power and the circumstances that surrounded him in Israel and the kingdoms of all the other lands." Now, we have the story of David in the books of Samuel and Chronicles. And those books, as we have them in the Bible, were composed probably Samuel in the days of Jeremiah and probably Chronicles in the days of Ezra. And I think those men were actually responsible for the composition of those particular writings. But as the book of Chronicles tells us, those things were brought together from a large volume of sources that were written during the actual times of David and the other kings that we read about in the books of Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. And particularly in the case of David, we're told here in 1 Chronicles 29, 29, and 30, that the records of David go back to his own time, that they were originally written down by Samuel the prophet, by Gad, and by Nathan, who were contemporaries of David, people who shared in episodes in his life. And as we read in the book of 1 Samuel, we'll be looking at things that were written by each of these men, presumably those that deal with David before the death of Samuel are largely written by Samuel, but not entirely. There are some of those that would seem to have come certainly from the hand of Gad. If we go to 1 Samuel chapter 22 and verse 5, this is before the death of Samuel, which is recorded in the 25th chapter of 1 Samuel. But in 1 Samuel 22 and verse 5, we have reference to the fact that Gad was with David when David was fleeing from Saul, that Gad was telling David some of the decisions that he needed to make and the places he needed to go. And so there is an overlap of the testimonies of these men. And then again, we have Gad much later in the story of David's life, when David makes the error that we'll talk about later this week of ordering a census of Israel. He seems to be looking at things the wrong way, and Gad is the one who comes to him with a message about God's judgment because of that census that David has ordered at that time. So Gad is one who is with David from his days in the wilderness that we'll be talking about tomorrow, all the way up through really pretty much the end of his life. Nathan comes into the story a little bit later. The first time we meet Nathan is in the 7th chapter of 2 Samuel, when David asks Nathan, "Should I build a temple for God?" And Nathan says, "Well, of course you should build a temple for God." And then he finds out that wasn't really what God wanted him to say. And then Nathan is in the storyline after that all the way up through the time when Solomon becomes the king. But we have this overlap of the testimonies of these three inspired men, Samuel and Gad and Nathan. And so we have different strands that come together to give us the story of David as we have it in the books of Samuel and Chronicles. Now, there are a lot of things in common between the story of David and Samuel and the story of David and Chronicles. But obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but if you look at it, you'll see fairly quickly that the story in Chronicles is much, much shorter. And it has a lot more lists of names involved, the heroes of David's kingdom. One of the reasons that the story in Chronicles is so much shorter is that the story in Chronicles doesn't deal with the failures of David's life. It really doesn't talk about the grand episodes of sin that we read of and the failures in David's family and the conflicts in David's family. The one real error that Chronicles talks about is the error that David made in conducting the census when his kingdom was large and powerful. And there's a reason for that, the difference in perspective between those two accountings from the days of Jeremiah and the days of Ezra. In the days of Jeremiah, when the Samuel account was put together from all of these sources, it was very important to remind the people of their sins and errors and how important it was for them to straighten up their act before God. And so that emphasis on error is very much a part of the Samuel King story because of the need to avoid those things. When we look at Chronicles in the days of Ezra, when that story was brought together, there was a great need for a religious revival, for a restoration of temple worship, for getting people back in line with an appropriate liturgy based on the things that had been done in the past. And the book of Chronicles is really addressing appropriate temple worship, using the temple and the law as it should be used, and trying to set things in order once again. That's something we'll talk about a little bit later on, but I wanted to get a little bit of the idea of the basis of the story of David that we have in the two different major sources that we have today, the books of Samuel and Chronicles, before we get too much into the story of David itself. Another thing that I want to talk about just a little bit, and if you look in your notebook on the first page, there is a very rough timeline there, and it's only intended as a rough outline, as a timeline to give us a general sense of where things fall in the story of David. Before we look at specifics there, I wanted to point out a couple of things that are kind of difficult or problematic when it comes to dealing with a timeline or a chronology in the Bible. And I'm not going to do this in any great detail either. But one of the things that we deal with in biblical chronology is that we are looking at relative timekeeping. You and I are used to the idea of the year 2000, that there has been a long period of using the same calendar, and so there is a sort of a fixed point in time that everything else is based on. But that has not been the way that timekeeping has been done historically until really fairly recent times. That kind of timekeeping has not been done. If we go back to the book of Exodus, when we read about the children of Israel being about to depart from the land of Egypt, we're told that the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, on that very same day it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. Now, that's not based on some absolute date that everything else is going to be based on from that time forward. That's based on a relative date, looking back at the period of sojourn. And in fact, even that relative date is a little bit hard to interpret. Some people have looked at that and think that it's talking about the time period in Egypt, and others look at that, and this seems more likely the case, that the sojourn referred to there is the time period of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the land of Canaan without a homeland, and then the people in the land of Egypt after the family of Jacob went down into Egypt. And so dealing with those relativistic dates, as in 1 Kings 6:1, now we have a reference back to the time when they came out of Egypt, 480 years after they came out of Egypt. Solomon was working on building the temple. And then in 1 Kings 15:1 and 2, just as an example, and there are many, many examples of this, in the 18th year of the reign of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, Abijah became king. And if you read through the stories of the kings, this is how the reign of the kings are dated, relative to the previous king and relative to the king in the other land, whether it be the land of Judah or the land of Israel. Or if it's Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 1, in the 25th year of our exile. So we don't have a continuous chronology listed for us in the Bible. We don't have a continuous chronology listed for us where we just start out at one point and then list everything based on that point, but rather we have relativistic dating. It's going to come up again next week when we talk about the life of Christ. And so sometimes it's a little bit tricky to go back and establish the actual dates for when things happened. But we can, in most cases, get a pretty good general idea of when things happened biblically by comparing them with a variety of sources. Another challenge that comes into this story in dating things is the fact that in the Bible, when we talk about relativistic dating based on the years of the kings, the fourth year of Solomon's reign, the 18th year of the reign of Jeroboam, very often we have overlaps in the reigns of the kings. And the story of David is one of those stories where we have an overlap in the reigns of the kings. How long did David reign? Does anyone recall? 40 years. How long did Solomon reign? 40 years. So the reign of David and Solomon was 80 years, right? No, it wasn't. Because Solomon became king before David died. There was an overlap. We don't know how long that overlap was. But we know that Solomon became king before David died. David was still king. In fact, Solomon was anointed twice in order to establish him firmly as king over Israel. And we don't know just how long the overlap of the reigns of David and Solomon were. And so we treat that as 80 years, but really it wasn't 80 years. Maybe it was 78 years, or maybe it was 76 years, or maybe it was 79 years. I don't know. Because we don't have any clue, actually, in the Bible as to just how long the overlap of the reigns of David and Solomon were. But we know that there was one. And so, in terms of relativistic dating, that makes perfect sense to talk about the 40 years of David and the 40 years of Solomon, But when we like to lay things end to end and look at them in absolute terms, it doesn't always make complete sense. Now, with that sort of caveat out there for us to think about the limitations sometimes of dating things biblically, let's nevertheless look at the timeline, which you'll find on page 1, I think, of your notebooks, and just give a real brief overview of this. We have in about 2000 B.C., and that's plus or minus, depending on how you interpret that, 430 years of the sojourn and a couple of other factors, but 2000 years B.C., approximately, we have the stories of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And if we just have that in mind, that Abraham is at about 2000 B.C., that'll work out pretty well for us to get things in an appropriate sequence. We come down the line to about 1526 B.C., and even though there's a real definite number written there, it isn't about an approximation. That's why the little C in front of it, circa or approximately about 1526 B.C., we have the birth of Moses. We come down the line from that about 80 years, and we have then the exodus from Egypt going to Mount Sinai and the beginnings of the wilderness wanderings that lasted how long? 40 years. There are a lot of these 40s that turn up in biblical chronologies. So in about 1406 or 1407 B.C., somewhere right in that time frame, and by the way, if you go to the movies or if you watch old movies, whether it's the Prince of Egypt in recent times or the Ten Commandments several years ago, or if you read a whole lot of commentaries and things that deal with the chronology here, they're going to place the Exodus from Egypt in the 13th century, not the 15th century, but that's really not possible. Ramses II could not possibly have been the pharaoh of the Exodus. It makes no sense at all, and that's also another story, but the Exodus had to take place in the 15th century B.C., late in the 15th, or the middle, or second half of the 15th century B.C. in order for it to fit into biblical chronology, and there are a lot of things that substantiate that in secular chronologies as well. Anyway, we come then into the period of the settlement with Joshua in the late 15th century, 1406 B.C., and we move from that into the story of the Judges. Does anyone remember kind of the summary that's given of the period of Judges in the book of Judges three different times? In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did as they saw fit. Everyone did as they pleased. And is the intention then of the book of Judges to give us a picture of a golden age? This was really a great time in Israel when it was like that? Wouldn't it be great to, if anyone's a libertarian, sorry about this, but wouldn't it be great to have everybody libertarians and no government structure and just everybody does what they want? Well, that's what it is in the book of Judges. You know, they don't have any real government structure. And one of the pictures that we're intended to get from that is that man doesn't really operate very well under those conditions. People need authority. People need governing structure. People need to have things set in order in an appropriate way. And in those days, during the period of the judges, people were doing what they pleased. Even when they had judges, some of them for 20 years, some of them for 40 years, even when they had judges for various periods of time, very often those judges were actually only dealing with a portion, a subset of the family of Israel, not with all of the family of Israel. And as in the stories of the kings, very often there are overlaps in the stories of the judges. And so if we just add those numbers up in the book of Judges, we don't get a real picture of the duration or the time period there either. We come down to about 1100 B.C., approximately 1100 B.C., we have the story of Ruth and Boaz. This is in the days of the judges. That's made clear to us in the story of Ruth and Boaz. This is in the days of the judges. This is the story of the lineage of David, how the family of David came about. Down in 1050 B.C. or so, we have Saul becoming the king of Israel, the middle of the 11th century B.C. Now, who was the judge immediately before Saul became king of Israel? Samuel, okay? And Samuel was raised by a man who was both a priest and a judge, and who was that? Eli. But Eli wasn't his father, right? Eli was not his father. Eli was the high priest, and he was a judge of Israel. He had led Israel, and not as effectively as he should have. He had had a number of things that were brought against him in judgment by God, which was the case really of several of the judges. They didn't have an exemplary record when all the factors were considered. But Samuel was the last judge of Israel, as we reckon these things. He is the last one named as a judge of Israel, even though he tried, in fact, to pass his authority on to his own sons. And why didn't that work out? His sons were what? His sons were corrupt. They were scoundrels. They were taking advantage of the position and the power and trying to enrich their own lives with the power and authority of being judges. Samuel tried to establish his sons as judges in Beersheba, and the people did not appreciate it because their character was not like the character of Samuel. One of those sons was named Joel, and I want to remember that name because it's going to come up later on as we talk about the story of David. But one of the sons of Samuel was named Joel, and he did not get a good mark in the analysis of his character in the story of Samuel in the 8th chapter of 1 Samuel. But later on, he becomes important because of the heritage he leaves behind. In about 1050 BC, as I said, Saul becomes king of Israel. Why did he become king of Israel? The people wanted a king. And what's the rationale that is given when the people wanted a king? We like to be like the other nations around us. The other nations around them looked better to them. The grass was always greener on the other side, you know. In the story of the judges, when we're told that they didn't have a king and everyone did just as they pleased, was that really what God had set in place in the law when he gave the commandments to Moses? Should they have been in that predicament of having no governing authority, having no leadership, and not knowing what to do?
No.
What should they have had? They should have had God as their king and a leadership of priests that taught them the law, and they should have had tribal councils with the elders that had been set in place, the judges of Israel that had been set in place by Moses to hear disputes and to settle matters that needed to be settled. There was an authority structure that God had ordained in the law, but they weren't really using that appropriately. And when they looked around at the nations around them, as we come to the 8th chapter of 1 Samuel, they said, this isn't good enough. We really need something else, and what the other nations are doing looks pretty good to us, so give us a king to reign over us. And Samuel followed through on doing that because God told him to. God says, go ahead and do that. Give them what they're asking for. They are not rejecting you. They are rejecting me as king, as they always have since the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt. We come along and we have David being born at about 1040 BC on the timeline, which is to say Saul has been reigning now for how long?
10 years.
About 10 years. Now, if you wonder how we arrive at that by going down to the next time reference here in 1010 BC. And these things are based in turn on what we have further down the line in 966 BC. These things are all arrived at by working backwards in the chronologies that we're able to put together, by working backwards. And I want to drop down to the bottom of the list on your timeline, on your chronology there, and look at the last thing on the list, 587, 586 BC. The Babylonian captivity, the destruction of Jerusalem. Where do I find the story of that? Where is the story of the Babylonian captivity and the destruction of Jerusalem? Second Chronicles has an account of that. Second Kings has an account of that. The latter chapters of the book of Jeremiah have an account of that. All right. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah look back at that. That was really a crucial event in Old Testament history. And it's an event that we can pretty well date, not only from the Old Testament accounts, because really they leave us with a big gap there that we are not able to fill, but rather that's an event that we're pretty well able to date by looking at the records that have been rediscovered in modern times, records from Babylon and records from Assyria. And those records have been used to establish, because of their connection with biblical events, have been used to establish the date of 587, 586, and there's dispute about the year there, whether it was 87 or 86, but have been used to establish the time of the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple. Now, that was a crucial event in the life experience of the Jews, and working backward from that, the Old Testament really is built around that event to a great extent, and even when we look at the genealogy of Jesus in the first chapter of Matthew, we see the emphasis that Matthew gives to the destruction of Jerusalem, the beginnings of the captivity. Well, that captivity had really begun in 605 BC. That's when Daniel was deported. That was when Nebuchadnezzar first became the ruler of the city of Jerusalem in 605 BC. And working backward from that again, using the annals of the Assyrian kings and using the biblical accounts, we know pretty well that the Assyrian captivity was begun in 722, 721 BC for the northern kingdom being destroyed, Samaria being destroyed. Working backward from that, we come to the time of Solomon's death, and I'm not going through all the workings on that. Both. Depending on what you're looking at with the 70 years, because the 70 years plays out in different ways. The 70 years plays out consistently, though, in these different ways. In 605, with the beginnings of the captivity and the first people deported, there is a 70-year clock that begins, and that clock winds down when Babylon falls to the Medo-Persian Empire and the commandment is given by Cyrus that the Jews can go back to their homeland and rebuild the city, and Zerubbabel leads people back. And that's in 536, 535, in that time period, 70 years after the beginnings of the captivity. But then again, the temple was destroyed in 586, and in 520, they really in earnest, under the pleadings of the prophet Zechariah, and his contemporaries, they really in earnest began rebuilding the temple in 520, and they completed and rededicated the temple in 516, which was 70 years after its destruction. So the 70 years of captivity actually plays out, and those are not the only two ways, but those are two specific ways that the 70 years of captivity are played out in the biblical scheme. God used that 70-year time clock for several major events during that period of time. So the captivity begins in 605, and there's a clock that's running from there for the Jews to be able to go back to Jerusalem. The destruction of the temple occurs in 586, and there's a time clock running from there, again of 70 years, before the temple is going to be dedicated once again and put back into service by the Jews. Any other questions? Because I'm just really skimming this chronology stuff, because it's kind of like math that Mike was talking about yesterday, and I find it very interesting to put things into this kind of perspective, but I know not everyone really wants to spend a lot of time on chronology. Without going into any details whatsoever, looking at the numbers of the kings and so on and so forth, we can pretty well establish that Solomon died in about 930 BC, which means that he began to reign in about 970 BC, and the temple was the beginnings of the building of the temple were in about 966 BC, the fourth year of Solomon's reign, as we have reference to on here. Working back from that fourth year of Solomon's reign with the 480 years takes us back to the time when the Israelites came out of the land of Egypt in 1446 BC. That's how we got the number for the Israelites coming out of the land of Egypt. But the things that we are most interested in for the sake of this study, the things that we're going to be looking at this week in this class talking about David, are those dates between about 1040 BC, the birth of David, and down to about 970 BC when Solomon becomes king of Israel. And even though I have it listed here as 970 BC, the letter C in front of that is to tell you it's just an approximation, because I don't know the exact year when Adonijah tried to take the throne and Solomon became king of Israel. I've already told you there is some overlap in the reigns of David and Solomon. And so there is some leeway that needs to be given to the exact year in which that took place, that Solomon became the king, because David's reign did overlap that. All right, we'll go through the details as we go along in the story of David. We'll go through some of the details of David's life. But this puts him into a perspective basically being halfway between what two major things? Okay. David is basically halfway between the birth of Christ and Abraham. And if you look at the genealogy of Jesus recorded in Matthew, which we'll take a look at next Monday, I think, we're going to see that Matthew emphasizes three basic things. He emphasizes Abraham, he emphasizes David, he emphasizes the Babylonian captivity as leading up to Christ. Those are the things that he points to specifically in terms of the passage of generations, 14 generations, and he has a real purpose and point in making this emphasis, 14 generations from Abraham to David, and 14 generations from David to the Babylonian captivity, and 14 generations from the Babylonian captivity to the coming of Christ. But he emphasizes these major events in the story of the history of Israel. I want to take also a little time today to just look at the general situation in terms of the map. Thinking about the place where the story of David takes place and the world situation in which he comes to power. And this is, I hope you recognize, just a general map of the eastern end of the Mediterranean world there. Hopefully you recognize the boot of Italy up there and realize that Egypt is down here and the Red Sea is down here. In modern terms, Saudi Arabia would be over here. And Israel is right in this vicinity here. You can maybe make out where the Sea of Galilee is and where the Dead Sea is, and that kind of describes to us the northern and southern ends of the land of Israel. Well, around Israel, which was the place where David's story takes place, is in Israel, primarily. Around Israel, we have a number of very important major powers. One of those powers, of course, is Egypt. Egypt was a great power during much of the period of Old Testament history, up until about the time of the rise of the Neo-Babylonian Empire under Nebuchadnezzar, and then they were basically broken, never to rise again. But Egypt was a great power and a great player through much of the story of the Old Testament. And they were a serious consideration in the days of David. But it's very evident in the story of David, and I think that if we get the Egyptian chronology right, it probably is also played out in the Egyptian chronology, that Akhenaten and Tutankhamun and Horemheb are probably the pharaohs there. And I like the chronology that a man named David Rawl has worked out on that subject. They're probably the pharaohs at the time of King Saul and King David and the early reign of King Solomon. But it's a time when Egypt is in decline, and that's one of the reasons that David and Solomon are able to do the things that they do, is because Egypt is not a great player on the scene at this point in time. There are really only two things about Egypt that come into the story as far as David is concerned. One of those is the fact that one of David's mighty men killed an Egyptian. And that story is something that we might touch on later on. Another of those is that, I said two, there are actually three. When David is trying to find out what happened to his family in the story of Ziklag that we'll look at later, it is an Egyptian slave that they find that tells them which way to go and where to find the booty and the people that have been carried away. And then later we have the account that one of David's mighty men had killed a huge Egyptian, had taken a spear away from him and killed him with his own spear. But the most significant reference to Egypt in the story of David is actually in the story of Solomon. What happened with Solomon in connection with Egypt? Married the daughter of Pharaoh. Now that's really bizarre. Egyptian pharaohs did not give their daughters in marriage to foreign powers. They did not form alliances that way. And that's one of the reasons why I think that David Rawl's chronology works very well when he puts Horemheb, who had been a general in the army before he became a pharaoh, as the likely pharaoh that was reigning during the days of David, because he would have been a pharaoh who didn't have the same royal heritage that other pharaohs had, and he would have been a pharaoh who really needed foreign alliances and would have been desirous of that kind of relationship to an Israel that at that time was very large and very powerful. But at any rate, it is evident just in the way the storyline of Israel and David play out, even Saul for that matter, that Egypt is not the huge player on the scene at this point in time that it was at other times during Israelite history. We also have over in this end the kingdoms of Assyria and Babylon, and there are times when they are huge players, but not at this time. They are in a state of quiescence at this time. They are not a huge economic or military power at this time on the historical stage. We do have other relatively minor powers that are big players in the days of David. Syria or Aram is a big player in the days of David, and David has a lot to deal with the Arameans. And then again, the Ammonites over in this area were a big problem that David had to deal with. The Edomites down in this area were a big problem that David had to deal with. And probably most significant of all, well, who are the most famous enemies of all that David had to deal with? The Philistines. And the Philistines are the sea people over in this side of the land of Canaan, the people who bordered Judah primarily and controlled the sea lanes, the sea trade on that side. And we'll have several things to say about the Philistines during the course of this discussion. But David had to be concerned, David and Saul before him and Solomon after him, had to be concerned with these great powers that surrounded them. Most of them initially much larger and more powerful than Israel itself, because Israel had been in a state of chaos and decline. They had not had any great power or authority. When Saul began building a kingdom, he really had a task ahead of him, because there was really no unity, there was really no power, there was really no power base, no technology. There were lots of problems that Saul faced in trying to build a kingdom. And while he initially seemed to have solved some of those problems, he inevitably ended up leaving most of them to David to find the actual answers to. A map that's going to bring us down a little bit closer to the land of Egypt. It's not a great map, but it has a couple of things that I wanted to emphasize in terms of the world situation that David was in as king. This map is a map that all the dark lines on here are representing trade routes. And if you look at these trade routes, if you're going to talk about Europe over here, or if you're going to talk about Asia over here, or you're going to talk about the Babylonian Empire, or you're going to talk about Egypt, where are the trade routes pretty much all going? Through Israel. All the best trade routes are going through Israel, either up the coast of Israel or through the land of Israel. And this particular trade route is the one that is known as the Way of the Sea, and that's a real important trade route. It's the most important trade route, really, in terms of the ancient world and the things that were going on at that time. And it's the one that Matthew refers to in the story of Jesus, which we'll talk about next week. But this made Israel a very important nation, not because of its size, not because of its power, but because of its location. God put his people at the crossroads of the world when he put them in the land of Canaan. He put them in a place where they were going to have to deal with the comings and goings of the commerce of basically the rest of their world. Everyone wanted to be able to pass through that area and carry trade goods. Everyone wanted to have the ability to control what passed through that area in terms of trade goods. And that is why a lot of the battles that took place, the battles that we read of in the Old Testament, that's why many of them took place, was simply over the ability to control this stretch right through here of the Way of the Sea, this trade route that was so fundamental, so very, very important along the plains and the easy passable areas there up along the seacoast, and then going across the Valley of Jezreel up around the lake. Places that become very important to us in the biblical story and the unfolding of God's works there. So God has placed Israel, and now when we look at the story of David, God has placed David in a place that is really crucial on the stage of world history. Tremendous things take place there, not because Israel is so big and so important, but because of where Israel is. And you know, I suppose that there is an analogy there. I won't spend a great deal of time talking about it, but I suppose that there is an analogy there for where God puts Christians. God doesn't put Christians in places where they are far away from the world at large. He doesn't put Christians in monasteries. He puts Christians in the thick of things, because where we are is where we can do the most good for the cause of the Lord. And God wanted his people Israel to be a testimony to the nations. He says so many times in the Law and in the Prophets. He wanted them to be a testimony to the nations. He wanted all these people who passed through that land of Israel to learn something about the God of Israel, to learn something about what real power is, and what a system of government God had given to them. And by and large, of course, they failed in that task. And the question lies whether we will fail in that task or not. When the Son of Man comes again, will he find faith on earth? Will we succeed at the crossroads of the world where we find ourselves in carrying out the plan and commandments of God? Well, I want to come down a little bit closer once again on our map. This map has all kinds of things that are not relevant to our study. It's really hard to find a single map that does everything that you want it to do. And this one does a lot of things I don't particularly want it to do. And if you just want to sit there and look at cities for the rest of the hour, it'll probably be very entertaining, but not very helpful to do that. I want us to think a little bit about the Philistines in particular. We read about the Philistines beginning in the book of Genesis. I said that they were along the border primarily of Judah, down in this area. The tribe of Judah occupying this area. The Philistines were primarily down in here, and they occupied what was really a very prosperous region of the land of Canaan. They had, for one thing, they had a lot of olive trees. The economy of the Philistines, we know from recent archaeology in this past generation that's still going on right now, we know that the Philistines had a very powerful economy based on sea trade, and at the heart of that economy was the olive oil trade. They were very proficient in the production of olive oil, and that was the basis of great power and prosperity for them. The Philistines first come into the Bible story in the book of Genesis when we're talking about Abraham. Now, they're first mentioned in the 10th chapter of Genesis in verse 14 in the table of nations there, and they are linked together with the Kaphtorites, which means to say they are people of the sea, and they are described that way in the literature of the Bible as well as other literature. They were a seafaring people. But we first come to them in a story, in the story of Abraham, in the 21st chapter of the book of Genesis, and we find that the Philistines are already there in the land when Abraham comes into the land. Now, as I read the accounts of the Philistines in the story of Abraham and then subsequently in the story of Isaac, it sounds to me like the Philistines at that time are almost a colony. When I read the description of them, it sounds to me like they have a kind of colonial lifestyle. Well, from other sources, we have a pretty good idea that the Philistines came into the land of Canaan from islands in the Mediterranean as a result of a great natural disaster that had destroyed their homeland and made it pretty much uninhabitable. There had been a volcanic eruption that disrupted their way of life. They'd had a strong civilization, but it had been disrupted by natural disaster, and they had taken to the sea, and some of them had settled down on the coast there. The Phoenicians, who settled further north, were their relatives, not exactly the same people, but they were their relatives and had come from similar origins back in the early days of post-flood mankind. In the 13th chapter of Exodus in verse 17, we're told that God did not want to lead his people through the land of Egypt, of the Philistines, when he was bringing them out of Egypt. And does anyone recall why God did not want to lead them through the land of the Philistines? It's in Exodus 13, 17, if you don't remember. God said, don't take them through the land of the Philistines. Why not? They weren't ready for war. They may face war and they may lose heart if we take them through the land of the Philistines. One of the things that suggests, I believe, is that the Philistines were a powerful people by that point in time, that this was not going to be an easy thing to pass through the land of the Philistines. And so God led them around by another way further south to take them to Sinai and then to bring them around into the land of Canaan without actually going through the land of the Philistines. That was the easiest route to follow. It would have been following that way of the sea that we were looking at earlier. It would have been following the easiest path to get them into the land of Canaan as far as geography was concerned and as far as the distance was involved, but it would have involved complications that God knew the people were not yet ready for. If we went to the 23rd chapter of the book of Exodus in verse 31, we have another reference to the Egyptians there. And let me turn and read that one. Exodus 23 and verse 31. God says to his people, I will establish your borders from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines. Now, the Red Sea is that area down below that we looked at on the other map. But God said their border would extend from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines. So in this reference, what is the Mediterranean Sea called? The Sea of the Philistines. What does that tell us about the Philistines? They had a lot of power and control and influence. They were a seagoing people, and the trade routes at this point in time pretty much belonged to them along the seacoast. It is the Sea of the Philistines. And so this is another indicator of what a successful people there were. Now, there are reasons for emphasizing some of this idea of the success of the Philistines, because when the word Philistine is used today, if I said of someone, oh, that guy is a real Philistine, what would you think I meant by that?
Barbarian.
A barbarian. Someone who's backward, someone who's stupid, someone who is incompetent. Now, where does that idea come from?
Flip Wilson.
Maybe it does. I don't know. But I think it comes largely from the story of David and Goliath, and the picture of a big, bumbling kind of a guy as a Philistine. Well, that's not what Goliath was, is it? What does it say he was? It says he was a warrior. He'd been a man of war from his youth, and everyone was afraid of him. He was big, but he was not bumbling, and he was not stupid. Well, maybe we could argue the stupid part just because of his position regarding David, but it was a pretty natural position for him to take when you think about it. Nevertheless, there has been a kind of an upgrowth of an idea, and the story of Samson probably plays into this too with his dealings with the Philistines. But they are not dumb in the way they dealt with Samson. They are very clever, crafty people. They don't have the values that you and I want to espouse as Christians, but they are a people who are powerful, who are wealthy, who are well organized. They are a people who have a technology that is higher than that of the Israelites, and archaeology has certainly borne that out, that they were ahead of the Israelites in terms of technology and most aspects of culture. They had art that the Israelites didn't have. They had iron working that the Israelites didn't have, and a variety of other things. And in fact, there's a reference to that in the story of Saul and Jonathan when they go up against the Israelites. We're told that when Saul and Jonathan were facing the Israelites in 1 Samuel 13 and 19, that there was something really lacking in Israel. Does anyone recall what that was? What did the Israelites not have? They didn't have swords. Why didn't they have swords? They did what? They didn't have iron workers. They did not have blacksmiths among the Israelites. Now, that may be because of a lack of education, but it's more likely because the Philistines would not allow it, because the Philistines had gained the upper hand. And one way to keep the upper hand was to keep a technological advantage. And so the Israelites had no blacksmiths, no one that could even sharpen their farm tools. They had to go to the Philistines for those kinds of services. There was arms control of a high order taking place there. But the picture we get biblically, and there are lots of encounters with the Philistines in the stories of Joshua and Judges and the early days of the book of Samuel there with Eli and Samuel and Saul. In these encounters with the Philistines, we do not get a picture of a people who are in any sense primitive. That's not the problem. Rather, we get a picture of a people who are corrupt, and that's the problem. There are people who follow false gods. There are people whose values are not according to the way of the Lord, and that's the problem. It's not a problem with technology. It's not a problem with intelligence. It's not a problem with education. It's not a problem with culture in the sense of being able to make things and do things and go places and rule people and organize cities. They were able to do all those things very well. But they were a people that were bound by idolatry and superstition and had values that would make it entertaining to blind a man and then have him come out and wander around in front of the people and stumble in front of the people. And who was that man? Samson. And find entertainment in that. Well, as I use the word Philistine in that sense, and I look at what's going on our television and theater screens today and in a lot of what's referred to as sports activity today, I'm not sure that there's really a whole lot of difference between being a Philistine and an American in terms of having a misplaced value system and in terms of being entertained by the wrong kinds of things and having a culture that can do all kinds of things but still missing the point of what life is all about. So I'm not so sure, but what modern America has more in common with the Philistines than it does with God's picture of what the Israelites were intended to be, and we need to be wary of that. Well, the story of the Philistines and their encounters with the people of God, with the Israelites, come to a kind of a head in the story of Samson, because the purpose that God had in mind when he said that Samson was going to be born and when he talked about what Samson was going to do, he said that Samson was going to begin the deliverance of Israel from the Philistines. He wasn't going to finish it, but he was going to begin it. This was going to be a long-term project. And Samson, of course, ended up giving his life in the course of his efforts to free his people from Philistine domination. And when we come into 1 Samuel, we see that the Philistines are still in this power position over Israel in the account in 1 Samuel. Because when we have the downfall of the sanctuary at Shiloh, the loss of the Ark of the Covenant, who is it that defeats Israel at that time and takes the Ark of the Covenant into their own hands? It's the Philistines. And who is the ruler of Israel at that time, the leader of Israel? Eli, the one who had been the foster father to Samuel. He is the leader of Israel at that time. Although Samuel is beginning to lead Israel in his own way, he is beginning to speak the word of the Lord, and Israel is beginning to pay attention to him. But it is in the time of Eli, in the fourth chapter of 1 Samuel, that the Philistine tide kind of rises to its height, where the Philistines move inland in Israel. And again, the Philistines are over here along the coast, which is to say that they are the neighbors of Judah, which is in this vicinity here. But we have the story of the Philistines as they come up here into Michmash, and then eventually they come up here to Shiloh, which is where the sanctuary was, and we know that that sanctuary, the house of God at Shiloh, was destroyed by the Philistines because of the account of Jeremiah referring back to that in, I think, the seventh chapter of Jeremiah. But the Philistine tide kind of rose to its height, there at the close of the life of Eli and the beginnings of Samuel stepping out and leading Israel. And we begin to see Samuel, after the story of the Ark of the Covenant, we begin to see Samuel exerting his authority and his leadership in the seventh chapter of 1 Samuel, when Samuel leads the people in battle against the Philistines. He calls the people together for a kind of a religious revival. The people have begun to cry out because the oppression of the Philistines is wearing on them and going on and on. And so Samuel says, if you really repent, if you really get rid of the gods that you've been worshiping, which includes the gods of the Philistines, then God will listen to you and God will deliver you. And so they make the effort to do that. They pour out a sacrifice of water before the Lord there. The Philistines hear about the assembly. And so the Philistines come to put an end to it. They didn't have a... is that the Fourth Amendment that has the right to assemble, or is that the First Amendment? Anyway, they didn't have a Bill of Rights. And so the Philistines were coming to put an end to that. And when the Philistines approached, Samuel prayed to the Lord. The Israelites were all getting frightened, and Samuel prayed to the Lord, and there were great hailstones and a storm that discomfited and threw the Philistines into disarray. And then the Israelites pursued them, and the high tide of Egyptian domination was broken. And we're told in the story of Samuel that in the days of Samuel, the Philistines did not again rise to that level, that Samuel was able to hold them at bay. Now, it doesn't mean that he was able to defeat them. It doesn't mean that Samuel was able to eliminate the Philistine influence. But it does mean that the Philistines no longer made their incursions deep into the heart of Israel and no longer were expanding into Israel as they had been before. 1 Samuel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. So the Philistines were subdued and did not invade Israelite territory again. Throughout Samuel's lifetime, the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines. The towns from Ekron to Gath that the Philistines had captured from Israel were restored to her, and Israel delivered the neighboring territory from the power of the Philistines, and there was peace between Israel and the Amorites. So Samuel had started things along this road, continuing what Samson had begun but been unable to accomplish in delivering the people of Israel from the hand of the Philistines. It doesn't mean that the Philistine power was broken, but that they were no longer on the rise, no longer on the ascendancy, gaining more and more Israelite territory as they had been. Does anyone recall the kind of government that the Philistine people had? How many rulers did the Philistines have? They had kings over their cities, and how many particularly are singled out as being the rulers of the Philistines? Five, all right? The five rulers of the Philistines. That comes into several stories in the Bible, including the story of Samson. The five rulers came to Delilah and offered her a bribe if she would deliver Samson into their hands. It comes into the story of Joshua. Joshua talks about, in Joshua chapter 13, the first three verses, talks about the unconquered land. Joshua did not conquer the land of the Philistines, and it mentions the five rulers of the Philistines there. The rulers of Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. Now, some of those cities are going to be very important in the story of David. Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. Do any of those jump out at you as being important in the story of David? Well, Gath, especially the city of Gath. Who came from Gath? Goliath. Goliath came from Gath. And the first great victory that David will deliver to Israel in the 17th chapter of 1 Samuel is a victory that is over particularly Gath and Ekron. But we have David involved through much of his life until he is finally able to really prevail over them with conflict with the Philistines of one kind or another, and particularly this awareness of how the five major cities of the Philistines. And it's interesting, when you look at the cities of the Philistines, we would have Gaza down in here, and for some reason this particular map doesn't show it. We have Ashkelon, we have Ashdod, we have Ekron. And then over here is the city of Gath, but it's got a little number by it because the city of Gath is not known with certainty. We don't know for sure where the city of Gath was. And that's kind of the primary city that David had dealing with among the Philistines. And we don't know with certainty today exactly where the city of Gath was, other than in a general way in locating those ancient cities of the Philistines. But all of them eventually were conquered by Israel. Eventually the Philistines were subjugated by Israel. But not until they had ruled over Israel for a long time, and again, remembered that the Philistines were a very wealthy, sophisticated culture. They had great power, they had great trade, they had great influence, and it was the influence that really was the greatest concern as far as God was, as God's attitude in dealing with the people of Israel. We have Samuel leading his people to victory over the Philistines in the 7th chapter of 1 Samuel, verses 13 and 14. And then we come to the story of Saul, and that, of course, is an important prelude to the story of David. The story of Saul begins in the 8th chapter of 1 Samuel when Israel asks for a king. We have Saul introduced to us as a young man who can't find his way when it comes to locating some missing donkeys in the 9th chapter of 1 Samuel. And we're told in 1 Samuel chapter 9 and verse 5 that Saul... I have 9 down, but I think I must not want 9. I must want 10. In 1 Samuel chapter 10 and verse 5, that when Saul had come to Samuel, Samuel told Saul that he was going to go to Gibeah of God, where there is a Philistine outpost. Now, Gibeah is very significant in the story of Saul because Gibeah is Saul's hometown. Now, even though the Philistines have been subdued in the days of Samuel, here are the Philistines with an outpost at Gibeah, where there is a high place, a place of worship, where Saul's hometown is. And Samuel tells Saul when he goes home to Gibeah of God, where there is a Philistine outpost, he's going to have an encounter with some prophets, and the Spirit's going to come upon him, and he is going to prophesy himself. As we continue down through the story of the things that Samuel says to Saul in verses 10 and 11 of chapter 10, 1 Samuel, when they arrived at Gibeah, a procession of prophets met him. The Spirit of God came upon him in power, and he joined in their prophesying. And all those who had formerly known him saw him prophesying with the prophets. They asked each other, "What is this? What has happened to Saul?" This is where Saul's family lives. This is where people know him. And there is a Philistine outpost at Saul's hometown. So he is becoming king under very challenging circumstances. He is going to be anointed to be king over Israel, and his hometown is occupied by the Philistines. And that's where his first battle really is going to take place in terms of the deliverance and leadership of his people. He's going to deliver the city of Jabesh from the Ammonites before he fights any battles at home. He's going to cross over the Jordan River and deliver the city of Jabesh Gilead from the Ammonites over in this region here. But his first real battle at home is really going to be in his own hometown of Gibeah, where the Philistine outpost is. Continuing on in that story, in the 26th verse of chapter 10, first, Saul went to his home in Gibeah, accompanied by valiant men. Well, this is going to be a challenge that the Philistines are not going to appreciate. And when we come to the 13th chapter of 1 Samuel, Saul has now rallied the forces, gathered an army, intended to begin the battle, but he has waited and waited for Samuel and got discouraged by Samuel not showing up. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 5, the Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers and soldiers, as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They went up and camped at Michmash, east of Bethaven. When the men of Israel saw that their situation was critical, that their army was hard-pressed, they hid in caves and thickets among the rocks and in pits and cisterns. If we continue on, we have Saul's son Jonathan saying to his armor-bearer, "Well, let's go see what we can do." And they go and visit the outpost of the Philistines, and they offer a prayer to God to see what God wants them to do, and then they end up defeating the outpost single-handedly and being the beginning of a domino effect in which Israel enjoys a great victory against the Philistines. Now, it would be great if Saul kept that up, if Saul continued with the initial victories against the Philistines, if Saul continued to rout the Philistines and expand the territory of Israel and deliver the cities of Israel from the hand of the Philistines, bringing them back into the kingdom of God. But Saul, of course, did not continue to do that. Saul's initial successes seem to have gone to his head. There are a number of things that bring that point very clearly to us, that Saul's initial victories went to his head, which is very prominent in the story of David. I just would like to look at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 15. 1 Samuel 15 has the failure of Saul in the matter of the Amalekites, that God had told him to go and destroy the Amalekites and destroy them utterly and destroy the animals utterly, and Saul failed to do that. He didn't obey the Lord. And when he came back, Samuel delivered the message to Saul that God was finished with him, that God had another man that would take his place and lead Israel according to God's design. And God was finished with Saul. Looking down at the end of that chapter, when we're told about Saul's departure from Samuel in verse 34, Samuel left for Ramah, but Saul went up to his home in Gibeah of Saul. I wonder if any of you noticed how Gibeah was referred to in the earlier reference that I made back in the 10th chapter. Gibeah of God. And what is Gibeah now at this point in the reign of Saul? Gibeah of Saul. What happens to take us from Gibeah of God to Gibeah of Saul? What's happened to the emphasis here? What's happened to the priorities here? What's happened to the perspective of Saul and the people here to move us from Gibeah of God to Gibeah of Saul? Well, this is the very thing that Saul is accused of by Samuel. He has been lifted up with pride that he thinks more of himself than he does of God. And that's brought to our attention in this little detail of just the way people talk about things. And of course, that very same pride in the way that Saul sees things and the way that Saul refers to things and the way that the people see and refer to things is what's going to end up coming between Saul and David when we have the story of David as a right-hand man to Saul and then as a foe of Saul because Saul does not trust him any longer. In the 16th chapter of 1 Samuel, we have the account of the anointing of David. And before we read that account, which will probably be tomorrow, I wanted to bring to your mind probably the most famous of David's psalms. And when I say that, what psalm do you think I'm talking about? Psalm 23, probably the most famous of David's psalms. And I invite you to turn to that, Psalm 23, and look at that with me. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. My question to you is, when did David write that? When did David write that? Did David write that as a young man? When he was hiding from Saul? Did he write it? Well, we can say one thing fairly clearly, right? And that is that he wrote it after he had been anointed by Samuel. Isn't that fairly reasonable to say that, since he says, "You anoint my head with oil"? To think that this is written after he's anointed by Samuel, which is in the 16th chapter of 1 Samuel. I've read this psalm and I have thought, you know, David must have written this when he was young, when he was relatively unblemished by the failures of his life. At this point in time when I read it, I really think he wrote it very late in his life, when those blemishes had taken their toll and when he had seen that he could survive, that God could bring him through. Now, you can have your own opinion about that. We can't know when David wrote this psalm, but it's a psalm that speaks to me as I read it of spiritual maturity. And when was David more mature spiritually? During his early days when he was so optimistic about God and so optimistic about the handiwork of God in his life, or during his later life when he had seen the depth of his own failures and seen so many things go wrong, and seeing that nevertheless God was still there for him, God still loved him, and God still cared for him? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know when David wrote that psalm, but as I look at it, as I see this psalm being one of only a couple that make direct reference of David's psalms, that is, to the anointing of David, it nevertheless seems to me that this psalm probably came about late in his life, and you may view that differently, and that's okay if you do, because we can't know. There's no evidence within the psalm other than the anointing of oil telling us that it must have been after 1 Samuel 16 when he was anointed, but not tying it down any better than that. I want to think for a moment about the Psalms of David, and this will be the last thing that we do this morning, by putting something up here that is not biblical. You know, there's a place where we have an accounting of all the things that Solomon wrote, how many proverbs he wrote and the subjects of his proverbs and how many songs he wrote. And of course, we only have a small portion of those preserved for us in the Bible. There's no biblical statement about how many psalms David wrote or the quantity and volume of things that he wrote. There is something in the Dead Sea Scrolls in one of the song books. They found quite a few song books in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And if you don't know what those are, I'm not going to explain it right now. But among the Dead Sea Scrolls from the time of Christ and before, There's a songbook that has a lot of the biblical songs in it, as well as some other songs that are not in our Bible. And there's this statement about what David had done. David, son of Jesse, was wise and a light like the light of the sun, and a scribe, and discerning and perfect in all his ways before God and men. And the Lord gave him a discerning and enlightened spirit, and he wrote 3,600 psalms and songs to sing before the altar over the whole burnt perpetual offering for every day, for all the days of the year, 364. And for the Sabbath offerings, 52 songs. And for the offerings of the new moon, and for all the days of the festivals, and for the Day of Atonement, 30 songs. And all the songs that he uttered were 446, and songs for making music over the possessed four. And the total was 4,050. All these he uttered through prophecy, which had been given him from before the Most High. What was the attitude that the Jews of about the time of Christ had toward David? And we can tell that. This is in the status of legend here rather than historical fact. But what can we say about the attitude that the Jews in about the time of Christ had toward David? What was he to them? He was a prophet. Well, that comes out for us in the New Testament, doesn't it? When you look at the pages in your notebook, there are some things that are presented as descriptions of David. And when Peter is speaking on the day of Pentecost, and you would find this on page 3 of your notebook, in Acts chapter 2, verses 29 and 30, Peter says, "Brothers, I tell you confidently, the patriarch David died and was buried. His tomb is here this day, but he was a prophet. He was a prophet, and his writings were held in high regard." How many psalms do we have in the book of Psalms in our Bible? 150, okay? And a portion of those are ascribed to David. If you've ever looked at the psalms and paid attention, there are superscriptions on a number of the psalms telling us how many were written by different, or telling us rather who the authors were in some cases, but not in all cases. Of the 150 psalms in our Bible, and this information is also on page 4 in your notebook, David is given a superscription on 73 of those 150 psalms. 73 of them are attributed to David, including Psalm 23 that we looked at today, and several other psalms that we'll be looking at in the course of the week. I want us to consider a little bit of the influence that David had in that respect, the long-standing influence, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of these ideas tomorrow. About the multitude of songs and the kinds of songs that David wrote. But I want us to think about the kind of influence, the lasting influence that David had, and bear that in mind as we go along through the course of this study and talking about David. In the descriptions of David, the first description that we have, and this is what I'm going to close with today, is the first and last descriptions of David that we have in the Bible. The first one is in 1 Samuel 13 and 14, before David is ever named to us, before we ever have his name. And what is David described as in 1 Samuel 13, verse 14? A man after God's heart. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people. And the last description of David we have is that given by Saul of Tarsus, Paul, in Acts chapter 13, verse 22. After removing Saul, he made David king. He testified concerning him, "I have found David, son of Jesse, a man after my own heart. He will do everything I want him to do." And when we look at the story of David, that opening and closing testimony of who David was, that he was a man that God considered to be after his own heart, that's going to be a very important factor in thinking about both the good things that David did and the bad things that David did and how he handled them. And we'll pick up with the 16th chapter of 1 Samuel tomorrow. We're going to begin the story of David in the 16th chapter of 1 Samuel this morning. Yesterday we talked about various background aspects to the story of David. We talked a little bit about the countryside, the fact that Israel was intended by God to be at the crossroads of the world. We talked about the Philistines, who were the great adversaries of that time. We talked a little bit about how the big world powers that evidence themselves historically in Old Testament times there, the nations of Babylon, Assyria, Egypt, were really not on the ascendancy at the time of Samuel, of Eli, of Samuel, of Saul, and of David. And David had a lot of conflicts. His predecessors had a lot of conflicts with the Philistines. David, as we get into his story, will be having a lot of conflicts with the Philistines. We talked a little bit about